All right, it's 6 minutes after 8 o'clock. This is KPCW. We'll be starting with the Sundance Reel Sundance on the weekend in a bit, but we have the Avalanche Report, and Evelyn is calling in today. Good morning, Evelyn.
Good morning. Well, things are still dangerous out there. We've left the avalanche danger at considerable on all of those steep upper elevation slopes, so along the high ridge lines. And then it's going to be further complicated today because we're having some moderate to strong southwesterly winds. The winds have gotten quite strong along the high elevations in the Cottonwoods. The Park City Ridge Line, they're just sort of moderate speeds, but they are going to be drifting snow once again into sensitive wind slabs. So two issues. First, you just want to stay off of all those steep upper elevation slopes because there's a considerable avalanche danger where you could trigger a slide into one of the older weak layers in the snowpack, and then a moderate to considerable danger for triggering a brand new wind slab. So tricky conditions out there, and we advise, if you're heading out in the backcountry, really cautious route finding, have some conservative decision making. But the good news is that, you know, we had a bunch of storms over the week, so the low angle terrain is filled with powder once again, and those low angle wind sheltered slopes at the low to mid elevations, as long as you're not under something steep, are great choices for some safer options.
All right, so it is still possible to go out there, just
you've got to know your slope angles.
Okay.
Low angle slopes, look at what's above you, and just realize we're getting another storm tonight. So probably by tomorrow evening, another 6 to 12 inches of new snow.
All right. Evelyn, thanks so much for giving us a call this morning.
All right. Have a nice day.
Thanks, you too.
This avalanche report is made possible by SkiUtah.com and the Ski Utah app, a daily source for up-to-date information on the greatest snow on earth. Black Diamond Store, a source for climbing, skiing, and mountain gear. 2092 East, 3900 South, Salt Lake City.
Hey everyone, this is Gary Miller, Olympic Alpine Ski Coach, with this week's Sports Talk. Skiing with an athletic stance. Every dynamic sport, whether it's basketball, tennis, hockey, or skiing, has one thing in common with regard to technique. Athletic stance is paramount. Imagine a tennis player receiving a serve with their feet together. There's no way they can get to the ball in time, not to mention how ridiculous it would look. Same thing with a hockey player bent at the waist so much they couldn't see the puck. Skiing is no different, but because our ski boots are rigid, it oftentimes forces us to depend on our equipment to get down the hill. Even expert skiers are guilty of sitting back, bending at the waist, or having a goofy stance. A proper athletic stance will make your day of skiing both more enjoyable and also less taxing on your muscles and joints. So here's the skinny on skiing with an athletic stance. Start with your feet a little less than shoulder width apart, ankles flexed so your knees are in front of your toes, a slight bend in your knees, and a slight tilt in your pelvis so your sternum is in front of your knees. Lastly, your hands should be in front of you about as wide as if you're reading a newspaper. Now, once you've assembled your stance, it should look like you are a linebacker in football or a tennis player receiving a serve. If you can explode side to side on the hill, you've got it right. Superior technique begins with a proper athletic stance, so get lined up and go tackle the slopes. Sports Talk is sponsored by Team Schlopi Real Estate and Skis on the Run.
KPCW Classified Show. Brought to you in part by the Candy Erickson Foundation and Four Mountain Advisors, bringing art and science to ski mountain resorts.
Good morning. It is the first installment of Sundance Weekend. We're here for 2 hours. I'm here with I'm Rhett Bruff, and I'm here with my co-host David Darcy, film credit from Screen International. Or we were trying to figure out your description: film vagabond, man with no name. What is that?
Well, I have a name. It's just the. Yeah, the things that are attached to my name change so frequently or just pile up. So
yes.
You know, if you don't know me, consider yourself lucky.
And we'll be here for 2 hours talking to filmmakers and those involved with the world of Sundance. And we're brought here by Mark Miller Subaru. I'm instructed to say, love the experience at MarkMillerSubaru.com.
So much for public radio. Oh, well, shouldn't have said that.
Yep. You hang back from the mic when we say stuff like that.
Exactly,
yes. But to launch, we're here with the director, Shimon Dotan, who has a new film called The Settlers. Had its first screening yesterday, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
You were here a few years before with another documentary, which was maybe just as a lead-in to this one. You had a film called Hot House.
Yes, that's correct again.
And the topic of that one, what was the topic of that one?
That was the story of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. At the time, there were about 10,000 Palestinian prisoners incarcerated in Israeli prisons, and I had a unique opportunity to enter the prisons and to talk to many of them, and it gave, I think, quite a thorough portrayal of the logic or the individuals behind those involved in some of the most heinous terror attacks in Israel.
I was at the screening yesterday of The Settlers, which I liked very, very much. And what struck me were reactions after the film. The film takes you through the conquest of the land, decision to have settlements there, and then efforts by religious people on the right to take matters into their own hands, not to ask for permission to settle there, but to settle there and to create a fait accompli, which has been extremely difficult to change. And now we have these spontaneous outposts of settlements there, which are even more complicated. But you've shown your film to American audiences before and to American Jewish audiences. Talk about the difference between an American Jewish response and an Israeli response to a film on a subject like The Settlers.
The Settlers was not screened yet in Israel. Actually, yesterday we had the very first public screening of the film.
But I mean on a subject like
that. I would say that the response of some Jewish members of the audience was, in a way, I would say, expected, because it represents a typical divide between the Jewish crowd in the United States as much as in Israel. There is a good number of people that are proponent of the settlement enterprise in the West Bank, and there are a large number, I cannot quantify them, that are very much against it. And the reason to object it is they see the settlement as an obstacle to peace, but it's even deeper than that. They see the settlement as a threat to the integrity of the state of Israel, and that is my personal conviction as well.
Right, that there is ultimately it's the notion of democracy and the notion of a religious state are irreconcilable.
That's exactly so, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the point that you make also is that the settlements, in your view, are undermining the security of Israel.
But of course, they say the first and most important element in security of a state, of a nation, is the conviction that it exists based on solid moral ground. And the society has a fabric that is unifying it and keeps it together. And the settlement enterprise, whatever they represent and whatever they take the country to, is the absolute opposite of that.
Okay, obvious question. Why did it take so long for a film like this, looking at this subject so systematically, to be made? It's such an essential part of Israeli political life right now.
Well, it's maybe the answer is embedded in your question, because it is so much an immediate element in the Israeli daily life, daily politics. It's somewhat difficult to approach it. And even myself, I was waiting. Maybe I'll wait for the water to clear a bit, then I'll have a better perspective. But, you know, I'm working on this film for over 2 years, and every day there is a new element that I'm asking myself, should I include it, should I not? And I have to differentiate the film from a television reportage, and I stopped following the actual news. And I try to get a bigger perspective of the event and the implication that they have over the state of Israel in general.
Yeah, I mean, in any subject which is an ongoing, evolving subject, you wait for the water to clear, you die of thirst. You end up confronting this.
That's exactly so.
At some point. But we have an interesting problem in the West right now. They're not settlers, but we have occupiers.
Yes.
Who have moved on to a nature preserve, claiming they have a right to graze their cattle free,
yeah.
And they're armed, and they're saying that they have a right that transcends or it pre-exists to the rights given by the Constitution. And, you know, the well-meaning people of this country are at an impasse as to what to do about something like this.
I think it's a wonderful example. After the screening yesterday, a person of color approached me. He says, that so much tells our story. The narrative of the film tells my story. There are so many elements that I want to bring it to my people. I was quite surprised.
I was standing right there.
Oh, you were there.
I was standing right there. Want to say something?
No.
Oh, go ahead. Let's look 5 years from now.
Yeah.
What strikes me is that the people who are complaining about the film and very angrily in the audience may not have taken in all the facts of this, that it's a very disturbing problem that people who are calling themselves racist, who are taking credit for organizing killings, went to prison and then had their sentences reduced and are there saying the same things in freedom in Israel today. And you also look at this rhetoric and connect it, as Amos Gitai has done in his film on Yitzhak Rabin, to the assassination of the one leader in Israel who could have brought credibility to an argument on the other side of this question.
Right.
Well, both of you talked to me about the audience reaction. Was it angry that it was too pro-Israeli or too pro-Palestinian or what?
It was too anti-settler. I think that his film was biased. And how do you respond to the accusation that a film is biased? I mean, there's a notion.
But of course the film is biased. I never try to present anything other than my personal take of the events. I do not believe that there is a film or any commentary on a political ongoing condition that is not biased. And that's how it should be. But I'm not hiding my position, and I'm not trying to present anything, to pretend that I'm bringing the absolute balanced reality. I don't think that such a thing exists.
Okay, Shimon, is this film intended for an Israeli audience or intended for an audience outside? My sense is that the Israeli press confronts these questions every day. People are aware. No? Okay.
No. Okay. Actually, the Israeli press does not do that. And the international press does it in a very limited and superficial way. And I hope the film will provide a thorough background to take us to a better understanding of this.
Okay.
Situation.
Okay. And we have to wrap up a short conversation on a very thorough and complex topic. But if you want to dip into that, the settlers has a further showing. You're off today to the Redstone Cinema, Shimon, for the 1 p.m. Showing. And it's also
today at 9 o'clock in Salt Lake City, 9 p.m.
9 p.m. And then later on, the Temple Theater Wednesday at 9 a.m. Did they check with you on this? Yes, it's at the Temple Har Shalom Theater.
Yeah, bring your tefillin to the screening.
We should. This is Shimon. Welcome to the real Zion in Utah.
Actually, you saw the evangelicals in the film. Yeah.
And that's Friday at Holiday Village Cinema too. So Shimon Dotan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Additional support for programming on KPCW is provided by Sammy's Bistro, now offering breakfast Thursdays to Sundays from 7 to 11 a.m. Peterson Calder Real Estate, Berkshire Hathaway, selling Park City since 1989. Experience ParkCity.com. Sean Potter, Estate Planning in Summit and Wasatch Counties, WasatchLawGroup.com, 647-5951. Done to Your Taste Catering, 21 years perfecting life celebrations. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
This is Eric Schlope from Team Schlope of Summit Sotheby's International Realty and sponsor of Sports Talk on KPCW. Team Schlope lives and sells the Park City lifestyle. Our team can be reached at 640-5660 or tsreparkcity.com. Once again, that's tsreparkcity.com.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
And we're back to Sundance Weekend here with film critic and observer David Darcy. Looking at the documentary Mapplethorpe, Look at the Pictures. And we're here with a couple of Sundance veterans, Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbado, teamed up. And what was your first film at Sundance? Do you remember?
Our first film was the documentary Party Monster. And then we followed that with The Eyes of Tammy Faye.
Uh-huh.
And Party Monster was a documentary?
It was
just kidding.
A documentary before it became a feature film with Macaulay Culkin and Seth Green, etc. So we did both versions.
The documentary that became the feature film.
Yeah. We have to point out that these guys created some Utah history last night. They had the temerity to hire young men dressed with a little bit of leather, each of whom had a big smile. 20 years ago, when we were sitting in studios at this station, this would have been the most unimaginable thing in Utah. So you guys will burn in hell once again.
It's important to note those were local hires.
They were. That's exactly right. And they were very nice guys, very, you know, Utah guys. Friendly, and they posed. I can't tell you how many local women, including our very good friend Leslie Thatcher from KPCW, posed with these guys, and we have the pictures to prove it, and Facebook is going to put this on for an eternity.
Okay, were they like recreating the Mapplethorpe images or what?
Yes, it was. I think they call it living scenery. And, you know, Mapplethorpe himself said about S&M, he said it was sex and magic. He didn't consider it sadomasochism.
Okay, tell us briefly, give us the 10-second version of who Robert Mapplethorpe was and why this, in 2016, is an opportune time for a documentary about him, because there hasn't been one for quite some time.
Mapplethorpe was an artist who photography was his medium, and he dared to take pictures and exhibit pictures and force the art world to consider his work at a time when most of what he was shooting was just considered pornography. And then, of course, as a result of a huge trial and scandal, he became internationally notorious. And yet, 25 years later, everyone remembers that, but there's been no documentaries about his life and work. So it just was like, this is an incredible opportunity.
And coincidentally, the Getty and LACMA, two incredible art institutions in Los Angeles, are currently planning for the first time ever, a joint retrospective of his life. So the timing just seemed ideal. We were able to sort of follow the curatorial process of them putting together this show while we also were able to sort of re-examine his not only his work, but his life.
Right. And as a journalist who covered the controversy and has been covering this for, God, almost 30 years now, right, we have to remember that after the closing of exhibitions, museum directors put on trial, the time when Mapplethorpe was actually a verb, which meant to destroy the credibility of contemporary art, certainly in the minds of funders, that the Mapplethorpe Foundation, which eventually gave a lot of his work to Getty, had kept things quiet in exhibitions in the United States and tried to depornographize the perception of Robert Mapplethorpe as his work really gained a lot of value in the marketplace. So this is now. They won. I mean, they achieved what they wanted. Mapplethorpe is a classic, like it or not. And the pornography, or so-called pornography, is part of that classic body of work of Robert Mapplethorpe, which we're going to see in Los Angeles in the middle of March. So you had his brother, you had his sister in this film, and you had what's interesting and what's sad is that There are a lot of people who didn't make it 25 years later, but you still have people whom we might call the survivors of the disco wars or whatever you mm-hmm. what the AIDS battles or all those things that were part of that sort of overlapped in that culture of New York.
He didn't survive, but you're right. We were surprised, actually, at the number of people who did, especially those intimate lovers and collaborators, Jack Walls, David Crolan, Jack Fritcher, you know. I mean, that was the interesting thing. You think of Mapplethorpe as this singular artist. Just the name alone is so, you know, such a piece of branding. And yet he was always a collaborator. And he said, you know, taking someone's picture, it's a collaboration between me and that person, and it's often a very intimate one. And I think he was very strategic about the collaborations he did, even to the point of his death. And I think he was determined to survive his death. So the show The Perfect Moment, the more I think about it, the more it seems like Black Star, David Bowie's Black Star. He knew he was dying, and he was determined to make turn his death into a piece of art.
Yeah, we have to remember that the branding was initially branding by his critics, which the Mapplethorpe myth assimilated over time to its advantage. Although I have to say, once the right wing, once the conservatives won so many things, art became a lot less important to them, and you don't hear them complaining so much about contemporary art anymore.
You're right, but it's interesting because he was around at the time of AIDS and ACT UP, and one of the key tactics of queer activism was to take the slogan that demeaned you and own it. And I think that's probably what Mapplethorpe did. He took his critics' words, you know, look at the pictures, you'll be so disgusted and appalled, and he owned it. He said, yes, look at the pictures. Yeah, listen to my words.
I tend to think that this film and the exhibitions in Los Angeles, which are then the show's traveling to Montreal, this will not be anywhere near as controversial. We're not going to see much controversy here.
Yeah. It would be surprising. I mean, there you can look at pictures on your computer. I mean, you know, so times have changed. So
can't you get prosecuted for emailing them? I mean, is that, I don't know, people still seem to be prosecuted for things like that. Well, we'll have to bring in our lawyers. And
yes. Maybe ask Werner Herzog when he comes in. But did either of you ever meet him or just say, you know, in the art world universe?
Fenton and I spent a long time in New York in the 80s. We lived in the East Village. I mean, that's another interesting thing about Mapplethorpe and about this time. It was such an exciting time in New York where all these artists were so active and we ran in parallel, you know, tracks, but we never met him. We were very much aware of him, but we were fans, you know.
Yeah, everyone. Do you own any photographs?
Randy and I had no money in the 80s. And, you know, you could buy Man in Polyester Suit, for $2,500? But that, in the 80s, that was a lot of money. And we had, you know, a few quarters. Now, Man in Polyester Suit just sold for almost $500,000.
Tell the audience what Man in Polyester Suit is.
It's a picture of one of Mapplethorpe's greatest loves, Milton Moore, seen from below the head. You don't see his head in the picture. That was Milton's stipulation. But he's wearing a suit, his favorite suit. And out of his fly is this enormous penis. I mean, you can't look at the picture and not look.
Just made Utah history again.
And it's black.
just three strikes.
It's a funny picture. You know, I think the sense of humor in Mapplethorpe's work often gets overlooked. And I think at the same time as he was breaking boundaries and taboos, he was also funny and prankish and puckish about the whole thing.
Has Patti Smith seen the film?
She hasn't seen the film. Hopefully she'll see it soon. We hope she likes it.
Yeah. How much of this is that old cliche about an artist's work becomes valuable, you know, now that they're dead?
Well, that's a brilliant question, because AIDS at the time was a death sentence. So when he was diagnosed, he knew he was going to die. And his gallery dealer says in the film, you know, he didn't care about his health. What he was really interested in what it was doing to his market. And Jack Walls also comments that his market took off once people knew he was going to die. Once they knew there would be a finite amount of Mapplethorpes, suddenly his work exploded in value.
For some artists, death could be a great career move.
Yeah. Well, it was. I mean, Jean-Michel Basquiat was failing in the marketplace at the very end of his life. He died when he was 28 years old. And a year or two later, that was revived in a really significant way and has been soaring ever since.
Mm-hmm. So would you do a party monster type treatment? I mean, would this become a featured narrative film sometime in the future?
Not sure we would do that, but we have heard that one is in the works. So we think it would make a great feature film.
Who is playing Mapplethorpe?
Is Macaulay Culkin available still?
Macaulay is he maybe aging out of that role?
No, I think he'd be perfect, actually. It's a really,
really good idea. Oh, my God.
Jay Macaulay. Macaulay. We have probably a toll-free number somewhere.
Yeah, we made history again. and the showing's coming up. Man, you're running off to a 9 a.m. down at the Library Center Theater just down the road. On Saturday, also on Saturday night over at Sundance Redstone Cinema on a week from Saturday, 9 p.m., and a week from Sunday down at the Rose Wagner Theater. So Sundance veterans, Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Hi, this is Bambi from Jan's Mountain Outfitters, actively supporting KPCW. Different sports require different apparel, but the goal is always the same: performance, comfort, and style. We carry a range of clothing from Marmot, Club Ride, Prana, Patagonia, and Cool. Jan's has you covered. 649-4949 or jans.com.
Hi, this is meteorologist Curtis Ray giving you the latest forecast from ABC4. It comes to you live Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. right after NPR News. Brought to you in part by the law firm of Christopher K. Greenwood at the Gateway Center, 655-3680 or chrisgreenwood.com.
This is Mike Strawn, hard goods buyer for Cole Sport, a KPCW local supporter. Winter is here, and we have all the right gear to get you outfitted for the season. Brands like Burton, Salomon, Lang, Rossignol, Lizard, and many more, we're sure to have something for you. Cole Sport. Expect the unexpected.
Wasatch & Will Yarns is the newest sponsor of KPCW's Classified Show. We offer yarns from Noro, Blue Sky Alpaca, Jade Sapphire, Classic Elite, and more, along with knitting classes for all abilities, knitting accessories, and weekly knit nights. Located at the Redstone Shopping Center, wasatchandwool.com.
KPCW Classified Show, brought to you in part by the Candy Erickson Foundation and Four Mountain Advisors, bringing art and science to ski mountain resorts.
Welcome back to Sundance Weekend. We're with Brian Oakes, who is the director. And I guess for you, Brian, it's kind of the first time making a film.
It is. It is my directorial debut.
Yeah. So what leads you to into filmmaking for the first time? And this will lead you into introducing the special guests that you have with you.
Sure. Well, my background is actually animation and motion graphics. I've been doing that for over 10 years. So I've had a really great education of filmmaking, working with really amazing directors. Only in the past 2 years or so, I've transitioned into directing, and which brings me to my first film, which is Jim, the James Foley story. Is about James Foley, who was the first American journalist killed in Syria. and he was a very close friend of mine when I was a child. We've known each other since 7 years old. And his parents, Diane and John, who I've known almost my entire life as well, are here too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were just expecting Brian. So the Foleys, thank you.
I saw the film last week in New York, and I urge everybody to go to see this. You're going to see some testimony from fellow hostages in Syria that will be some of the most moving evocations of captivity and of friendship that you've ever seen. This is a very impressive film, and about a subject that you've seen on television a little bit and heard people talk about, but not in this way. So I love to ask the parents, how do you feel about seeing this on the screen? It must have been hard to, you must have talked about this endlessly, the way a film is shot. And what do you think of the final product? And what do you hope that it does?
Well, we're very impressed with how Brian has been able to capture our son, Jim. And just the beautiful person that Jim was, which is so hard to capture. So we're very proud of Brian's work and working very hard on our son's legacy foundation.
Brian, what can you tell us of the guy who was, the guy you knew as a teenager, as a 20-something, before he made the headlines? What are your memories?
I don't know how long your TV show your radio show is, but
it's just radio.
We could be here all day. No, Jim was, we grew up in a small rural town in New Hampshire called Wolfboro, so small community. Close-knit friend, and we stayed having a close-knit friend in those kind of environments. You stay in touch throughout your entire life, and Jim went to Marquette University, and I went to Syracuse, so two big schools, and then Jim went off to do Teach for America in Phoenix, and then he was, he taught in the Chicago prison systems at Cook County Boot Camp, and I was in New York City, but we still stayed connected. And he was always just a normal guy, the buddy that you go and hang out with. We did a great road trip at the end of our college, he was just an amazing friend. And when he went to journalism school and went off to Afghanistan for the first time to embed with the Indiana National Guard in 2008, He was definitely a transient guy. He was always around. He had friends all over the world, but still, we stay connected. And he was always really great at keeping in touch. So yeah.
How did you bring those fellow hostages together? And were there some who didn't want to talk about this?
Diane and I went to Europe. Diane and I went to Europe in the fall of 2014, simply because we had not spent any time with Jimmy in the prior year and a half, and we needed to catch up on his life, and so we became very close with the people with the freed hostages in the movie, and they were gracious enough to share Jim's story with us, and then with Brian, along with our son Michael and Jim's sister Kate. So they feel strongly about sharing Jim's in the jail experience, which just influenced them all deeply.
Yeah, this is a difficult topic, but it's in the film. what could have been done by the U.S. government to produce a different outcome of this story?
I think the major thing is that at that point, because of our national policy, the Americans in Syria were just not a priority. And that was the hardest part as a family. And that is why, through the foundation, we're working very hard to make American hostages a priority, because it truly is a silent crisis. I certainly didn't know that there are American hostages all over the world. And it's a very silent crisis, if you will. So it was very difficult to get Jim to be a priority.
Do you see anything encouraging from the progress that was made in the Iran negotiation?
Oh, absolutely. We really were – that was very hopeful to us, because it showed us that, you know, at least in that situation, the voice of our foundation, the voice of other Americans has been heard a bit, that we need to get our citizens home.
I think one of the most heartening things associated with the Iranian release of the American hostages from Iran is that obviously our country negotiated, and obviously we had something they wanted and they had something we wanted. Jim's situation was a little different because there was no government to negotiate with. He obviously was captured by ISIS. There was also the issue of our government not being willing to negotiate with terrorists. So once you're labeled a terrorist organization, there was no communication. We found that to be a horrible setback, because you can't – if you don't know your enemy or you don't know what they want, et cetera, it's very difficult to
impossible to
expect any progress in a situation like that.
Did you meet other parents who were in your position, parents of other people who were held captive and killed?
Only until very late in 2014, about 4 months before their execution, we came together. It was actually through some non-government people. We came to meet several of the other Americans. We had no idea that Jim was with three other Americans, when in fact he was.
Do you think, was there information that was being withheld from you? I can't imagine it's easy to talk about this, but there also, at so many steps, there are ways to have dealt with this much more effectively.
Well, this is part, one of the major campaigns of the Foley Foundation, is to find, we Americans have to be able to do better. All the European hostages essentially came home, and ours did not. So we are working very hard with the new hostage fusion cell and with non-government people to do a better job of making Americans a priority.
Yeah, you'll see, as I said, I'll just repeat, you'll see some moments of cinema that will overwhelm you in this film. I can only say that. So please go see it, the film, Jim.
And the first screening is today at noon at the Yarrow, and Tuesday at the Library Center Theater in Park City, Wednesday at the Mark, Thursday you're down to the Salt Lake City Library Theater, and next Friday back at the Redstone Cinema in Park City, and that Saturday the Mark in Park City. So the Foleys, John and Diane, thank you very much for coming. And first-time filmmaker Brian, thank you for being there. Maybe there'll be a second.
I hope so, yeah. Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Film Jim. Mm-hmm.
Get up and move, Park City. This is Stanton Jones from the Silver Mountain Sports Clubs, a KPCW supporter. We offer over 80 fitness classes each week to our members, including spin, yoga, aqua aerobics, Zumba, bar blast, circuit training, and more. We have two locations in Park City. Online at silvermountainsportsclub.com. Be stronger, live healthy, play longer.
Hi, this is State Farm agent Benita Vanderkoy, longtime supporter of KPCW. With over 23 years of State Farm experience, I assist clients with insurance and financial services needs in Wasatch and Summit counties. My new office is located in the Redstone Shopping Center near Whole Foods. I can still be reached at 435-657-2220.
This is Tim Henney.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Join us for The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. after NPR News.
Brought to you by the doctors at the Park City Specialty Clinic,
Grand Valley Bank and Heber Valley Bank, and Park Meadows Country Club.
And we're back to the Sundance Weekend with David Darcy. And I'm very pleased to have a guest this morning, one of the more significant names in film for, what, about 40, 50 years, Werner?
Somehow I am. Well seasoned.
Mr. Werner Herzog. And was the last time you were here at Sundance, was it Grizzly Man?
It was Grizzly Man, yes.
Yes.
And I still have the unfulfilled dream to test the Olympic ramp just at the entrance to Park City. But it has to be prepared, and I need to have these very large skis.
Large.
And I want to take off.
You know, one of your films that I like most is, now I'm sure I'm getting the title wrong, is it The Great Anguish of the Skiflieger, the Skiflyer, no. Steiner? What's the title?
The correct title doesn't matter. It's The Great Ecstasy of the Sculptor Steiner.
Oh, the woodcutter
Steiner, about a world champion ski flyer. And I did this film because it was my dream as an adolescent to become world champion in ski flying. So I was in training and I was fairly good. But an accident of my very best friend at that time stopped it from 1 second to the next. So that was the end of it.
Well, the topics you're interested in seem to sort of go all over the map. And for this one, you were looking at the internet as, lo and behold, reveries of the connected world. That was able to see the film on my computer, which is another sign of the connected world.
Yes.
What drew you into looking at the net in the first place, to get your arms around this huge topic?
Well, the strange fact is that I barely use the internet. I do not have a cell phone. I do not like it for cultural reasons. Yeah. I like to sit face to face with you, for example, and have a conversation. I use internet myself only for emails, sometimes Google Maps, and sometimes to check the weather in Park City, whether I need a parka or not. So that's about it. And I was drawn into it by a company that has done a film with me before about texting and driving, which was sponsored by AT&T, a public service announcement film. It's called From 1 Second to the Next, about catastrophic accidents that happened by people who were texting while they were driving. And it had a huge impact on the internet. It was on YouTube, and millions of people saw it. And now there was the idea to create a couple of short clips for YouTube on the internet, various aspects. And on the second day of shooting, it became clear to me that this was the wrong format. It had to be a long film, a feature-length documentary, because the tapestry of what is going on the internet is kind of amazing, and it's still unfinished business. I'd like to add more films to the one that I've done right now. But I ended up with a film that was completely different from what was the original idea.
Talk about that. What was... differentiate the film from the idea, if you could.
Well, when you are into doing, when you are into doing 5 minute or 6 minute films for YouTube, of course you are in a different ball game. It's a different rules, different sort of approach. And of course here, the connection between various of the persons that you see on camera makes a lot of difference. And how can I say? I just followed my curiosity. And this enormous curiosity leads me into things, seeing the contours, I think, sharper than people who are very much into it. You are sitting with a man who has made his first phone call at age 17. You have to imagine that. You see, I grew up in the mountains in a very remote area of Bavaria. We had no running water. We had to go to the well with our bucket and bring in fetch water. We barely had electricity. We had no toilet, I mean an outhouse outside. And, of course, no radio, no television didn't exist at that time, no telephone. And I made my first phone call literally at the age of 17. So now a man like that does something of the connected world. And I think I'm the right one because I'm kind of uncontaminated.
Why have you, by your own admission, you've resisted total immersion in the Internet? Why the resistance?
Because I want to immerse myself with human beings, not through an abstract web that's out there. I like to have you at my dinner table. It holds six persons, meaning my wife and me. We cook, and we have maximum four friends. And this is my social network, and that's how I function.
There were people in your film that... some of them come across an odd mix of personable, but a little creepy. Like the guy talking about the cars that drive themselves, and if they make a mistake, they will learn from it, and they will pass the lesson on to other cars,
and educate them not to do ones, yes.
But what you've shown is that there is that in this immersion in science. Personality is still a highly determining factor in all of this, especially right. Among the people you're talking to. And there is a kind of visionary or belief dimension to a lot of this as well.
It is true, but it's not unjustified because it is something that science fiction has not foreseen. When you look at science fiction literature, let's say 50s, there were flying cars and colonies in outer space and all this. And literally, by the year 2000, and NASA made films, and I quote a film, NASA foresaw a gigantic rotating system before the year 2000, where ore mined from the moon would provide the building materials. It's all, you see, that was on the radar of everyone. But the Internet, nobody foresaw. Even the pioneers who sent out the very first message from computer to computer did not realize the magnitude of what they were doing. Only 15, 20 years later, the room and the router from which and the server from which this first message was sent was converted into some sort of a shrine. But it took 15, 20 years until the pioneers realized what they had created.
And explain a little bit about the story of Nelson, the first guy you were talking about, and sort of his, he sort of went off down an avenue nobody else accepted, and you had to assure him that you don't think he's insane. I'm not quite sure what that story is about.
Well, you have to dig much deeper into his basic ideas, but it was a different methodology to, for example, verify texts and paste texts and connect it with similar texts and so completely different sort of route. And it doesn't function like this today in the Internet. You have Google and you type in certain terms and you get some answers and some results. And, of course, for hanging on for so long to his idea, he was considered kind of insane, and he admits it that people think he's kind of maybe insane, but he says for giving it up, would be even worse. I have to stick to my idea, which is a good idea. And I said to him, you know what, to us you look like the only one out there who is clinically sane. And he really enjoyed that moment. Yeah, yeah. So it's a very private moment, as I do not do interviews. I'm not a journalist. Yeah. I have conversations. And some of this charm of a conversation comes across. Yeah.
I was reminded in an episode that showed your discretion. It was the episode of the family that was victimized when the daughter maimed in an accident, and the image, the graphic images were spewed out on the internet, and you declined.
Millions of people saw it. Voyeurs saw it,
and you declined to show even an archive picture of the daughter. It reminded me of your Grizzly Man, where you did not you listened to the last moments of Tim Treadwell's attack by the grizzly bear, but you chose not to air any of that at all.
Sure, there's a borderline, and you have to understand it as a filmmaker. Each one of us is in this profession has to somehow formulate their own borderlines, but for me they are clear.
There are a couple developments that are happening that might be of concern. Just over on Main Street, there are these presentations of new developments in virtual reality. And what the effect is, each individual consumer wears a head, goggles.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, it looks a bit like Guantanamo, frankly, like Guantanamo prisoners. But what it is individualizing this to the exclusion of anyone else, it seems, in the consumer experience. But the other thing is that there seems to be a corporatization of the internet and a real concentration, almost like the oil companies were, that you have some of these being the largest corporations in the world. In fact, Google is now surpassing Apple. You see a danger in that also.
Of course, but it shouldn't make us too nervous. If you have a clear system of values and if you create your own filter, you would be doing all right. The same thing with virtual reality. You create your own filters and you will be all right.
Lo and Behold has its first screening here at the festival at the Mark tonight, and from there you go to the tomorrow to the Temple Theater at 9 a.m. and down in Salt Lake City at the Library Theater 9 p.m. That's on Monday. Then you're back this Saturday, Holiday Village Cinema at 9:15 p.m. And we're very proud to have that. We had the chance to have you in the studio, Mr. Herzog.
Thank you for
just to show you,
me.
I have a little dinky cell phone. I think that there are 20 messages piled up. I don't know how to erase them. So
yes,
I am with you.
Them.
I am with you.
There's solidarity here.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. If there are more than five, delete them categorically, but learn how to do that.
Thanks, Werner.
Thank you very much.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW is provided in part by CNS Creative, Strategic Marketing, Advertising, and Web Design, cscreate.com, Hideout Canyon, Master Planned Community on the Lake, info@hideoutcanyon.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
It is 9 o'clock, and you are listening to the Sundance Reel, Sundance on the Weekend, here on KPCW Park City at 91.9 and 88.1 FM across the Wasatch Back. And we're also streaming live on kpcw.org and on the NPR Stitcher, TuneIn, and now the KPCW app. You can get all your updates all day long by listening here to KPCW. We've got another hour of Sundance on the Weekend coming up. And we're posting everything to our website, kpcw.org, as well as our Facebook page, including every update from the Uber and, what's the other one, Blaze helicopter stories as they develop. So go to kpcw.org to get all your information.